Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back. First of all, thank you for helping us so generously during Pledge Drive. We exceeded just about $3.2 million in total pledges. We had a goal of $3 million. And so all of you who were so generous in your donations this past week, thank you again. We're deeply appreciative. If you were traveling or were ill or for any other reason we're not able to participate, we're still keeping the door open for you so you can be counted in this last pledge drive. If you want to make a pledge by going to relevantradio.com or use the Relevant Radio app, you're more than welcome to do that. We would love it if you want to be counted in that. But again, thank you very much. It was a success by God's grace and your generosity. 888-914-9149. Let's get over to Anita now in Chandler, Arizona, a town I know very well. I love Chandler, Arizona. Welcome, Anita.
Thank you. My question is about marriage, and my brother called a few weeks ago and said he's really excited. He's going to make his relationship with his girlfriend right. They've been living together for quite some time, and he said he's going to Vegas, and he's going to get married, and we are now going to have a new member in the family. So I just didn't say much right away, but then I wrote to him, and I said, I know you may be angry when I tell you this, but you won't be validly married. You're a baptized Catholic. She's a divorced Protestant. Unless there's an annulment or her husband dies, she's not free to marry you. He's never been married. So my question for you is there something else I can tell them, a book I can give him, explain how that is not a valid marriage? Because he sent me messages that you have to bleep out he's not happy, which I said, I'm okay with that because I want to speak truth and love to him, but I want to know how to explain this in love to others because I have a son who, he got married. He was going to get married in the Catholic Church, but he switched at the last minute and he is now married by his wife's sister who got a certificate online.
Okay.
So I've been asking people to pray for him as well because that's not a valid marriage either, correct?
Yes. Well, we could go into that as well. Let's stick with your brother for the time being, though, just given his circumstances. So you're right to be concerned, Anita, and I totally understand your desire to share the truth with him. And I can also understand, although I don't agree with it, I could easily imagine that he would be irritated and irked by this because you're kind of a fly in the ointment. He'd like to be able to go down this road without any friction, but you're raising, hey, don't forget, you know, Jesus said, if a man divorces his wife and remarries, he commits adultery. So why don't we begin there? Every single time that this issue arises, that Jesus speaks about this, he says the same thing. Now, there's one slight change in Matthew chapter 19. I'll come to that. But Jesus says, if a man divorces his wife and marries another, he commits adultery. And this, of course, is true with the wife who does the same thing. So as for the woman in question here, you're right. Your brother is not free to marry her because the church's presumption, until and unless it can be proved otherwise, the church's presumption is that that marriage is valid. And if it's valid, then he can't marry her because she's already married to another man. So the annulment process is the way in which the church is able to determine with a kind of moral certitude whether the marriage was in fact null or if it was valid from the beginning. And so a declaration of nullity is the church's statement on this issue after its due diligence in talking to witnesses and considering all the facts as they stood at the time of the wedding. And if the church declares, yes, that marriage was indeed null from the beginning, then she would be free to marry your brother, at least at that level. That would not be a barrier to her getting married. But the other barrier is, and you identified this correctly as well, is that for a Catholic, Catholics are obliged to observe the church's what's called its canonical form when it comes to marriage, which means, among other things, maybe the most central or most important things are to be married in a church and have the marriage witnessed by an official minister of the church, which would be typically a priest, could also be officiated at by a deacon, even a bishop. Now, there are situations in which the church does not require this canonical form, but that would have to involve permission from the bishop to grant a dispensation. And sometimes bishops will grant dispensations. There can also be certain extreme circumstances like war or some kind of hardship where there is no priest who visits this remote area for, you know, maybe a long, long time. And as I remember reading canon law, I think the rule of thumb is if it's at least a month that you would have to wait before you're able to get married, that's sufficient for the couple to get married, and they confer the sacrament upon each other. And so the church in its law foresees certain circumstances where you can't get married according to the canonical form, but if you can, you must. So in those situations, like your brother's, if he were to attempt marriage with this woman, not only would the problem of her prior marriage be, you know, an impediment or a problem, but also his lack of canonical form would mean that it would be an invalid marriage. So I'm going into this explanation, Nita, not for your benefit, because it sounds like you already know all this, but for those who are listening. So I think you're doing the right thing. Now, what would be a good book? Well, I would recommend a book. Actually, I'd recommend a couple of books. One book that I would recommend is called Three to Get Married. I don't know if your brother would read it. It's by Archbishop Fulton Sheen. He might read it. And if he does, so much the better, because then he'll have a good understanding of the nature of marriage. But also, I would recommend a book by a canon lawyer named Ed Peters. It's called Annulments in the Catholic Church, Straight Answers to Tough Questions. Now, the reason, even though he's not seeking an annulment, she should seek an annulment. And in order for him to understand what's at stake here, what I find so beneficial about this book is that it lays it out in layman's terminology so that anybody can understand it. And then he will see right there in black and white what the issue, this is a twofold problem he's got here, and he'll be able to see it in black and white explained to him. And it's not a ponderous book. It won't be, you know, daunting to pick it up and read it. It's actually very readable. So maybe start with that book if you don't think he would read the one by Archbishop Sheen. That'd be what I'd suggest.
And that's Annulments in the Catholic Church?
Annulments and the Catholic Church.
Okay.
And the author's name is Edward Peters.
Okay. The woman that he married in Vegas, she's not Catholic. So in terms of getting an annulment, that was one of my questions. How do they get an annulment if the Protestant Church doesn't offer them, or do they offer them? I'm thinking
No. They
don't.
Yeah, they don't. There is no such thing as, quote unquote, the Protestant Church. There are, you know, gazillions of Protestant offshoots of offshoots of offshoots. So there is no such thing as a Protestant church per se. But even if there were, that doesn't really matter because it's the authority of the Catholic Church that would adjudicate this. And so, yes, you don't even have to be a Christian to go through the church's annulment process. That's something that the church makes available for people, even if they're not Christian. But in her case, she is Christian. So what I would say is that if he really wants to get right with God, and hopefully he does, and if he wants to get out of this state of objective mortal sin, then he needs to sit down with the parish priest and initiate the process. It can be done, and it will really help to, as Jesus said, you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free. And what he will know then is whether or not this woman that he's putatively married to can in fact be married to him. He'll know with certitude whether or not he can do that. But that really would be the first step.
Okay, so he, mm-hmm. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay.
Is it my understanding then he can ask her to come to the Catholic Church and they can start the process of an annulment even though she's not Catholic?
Absolutely. She wouldn't even have to be Christian
for
that to happen.
Okay, I did not know that, so thank you so much for clarifying that.
You're most welcome, yeah. And I think if you're going to get a copy of this book for him, you might want to get one for yourself too, because it's very informative.
Okay, absolutely, I will. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. I appreciate your answers to
my questions.
Happy to help. Thank you. And there is also, for those who are listening, there's also a great canon law blog. It's called Canon Law Made Easy. And I just want to make sure I got that I have the correct address. Let me pull it up here for you. So where is it? CanonLawMadeEasy.com. CanonLawMadeEasy.com. Kathy Caridi is the canon lawyer behind this, and she takes all kinds of questions, marriage questions, just you name it. She talks about it, and she breaks it down in a very understandable way for the average person. So if you're interested and you want to kind of delve into some of these issues, Canon Law Made Easy. 888-914-9149. Just a word about this before we go to our next phone call. Remember that the Catholic Church did not invent marriage. Judaism did not invent marriage. No religion did. God established marriage as a natural institution in the Garden of Eden with Adam and Eve. Jesus talks about this in Matthew chapter 19, where he says, in the beginning, God made them male and female. And this is why a man leaves his family and clings to his wife, and the two become one flesh. And what God has joined together, let no man put asunder. So marriage predates all religions. It's an institution by God himself. Therefore, all marriage, all valid marriages, that is, are good. So two atheists who go to the courthouse and get married, that's good. And the church recognizes that as a valid marriage. A Hindu and a Buddhist get married. That's good. They get married at the beach with their ceremony. That's good. The church recognizes this is a good ordinance established by God, and people have a right to marriage. That's the other thing. People have a right to marriage. If that's what they want, they have a right to be married. And so whether you are Christian or non-Christian, doesn't matter whether you're Catholic, doesn't matter whether you're baptized, if the essential elements for a valid marriage are present, the church recognizes that as valid. Now, in the case of, let's just say two baptized Catholics, well, it's also sacramental. But the validity of the marriage will be true and it will be present regardless of what your religious background is, even if you have no religious background. The marriage between two atheists at the justice of the peace, as long as they have the essential ingredients and they have the capacity to be married, the church recognizes that as a valid marriage. This is why the church's process of an annulment. Now, the church can't annul a valid marriage. But what the church can do is determine, based upon the evidence and the testimonies, whether or not there might have been some impediment or obstacle that could have made the marriage null from the very beginning, even if all the parties involved didn't realize it. There can be circumstances where the marriage was null. And so this is the church's effort, good faith effort, to make that determination. And the reason it's so important is because more often than not, people want to be married. They want to have a love life. They want to maybe even have children if they're young enough. They want companionship. All the benefits that go with marriage, people want that. It's understandable. It's great. Marriage is wonderful. So because it's so important to know whether or not this woman that you want to be with is actually available to you, she may not be. She may already be validly married, or a man, etc. That's why the church's process is there, so that people can have clarity and they can have certitude. And they can know, all right, whew, okay, I am free to marry her. Or I'm not free to marry her because her marriage to the man before is valid. Therefore, she's not free to marry me. I'm not free to marry her. Now, that can be sad, but it's also the truth. And better to know the truth, right? Because as Jesus said, the truth will set you free. Rather than stick your head in the sand like an ostrich, and I don't think ostriches really do that, but you know, to do something to intentionally avoid knowing the truth is really bad, and that usually leads to all sorts of heartache and problems. 888-914-9149. Let's go to Dusty in Bountiful, Utah. Hello, Dusty. I've been to Bountiful,
Hello, sir.
Utah before.
Oh.
Lovely community.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I love it. I'm not pro-abortion at all, but I'm just really curious what a silver bullet to secularism like yourself would say to these abortion claims. I was just wondering, what would you say when they say, you can't tell me what to do with my body?
Well, I'd say if I'm Dr. Fauci, I sure can. Number one, I could tell you that you got to stick something in your body, and I'm going to tell you that you have to wear a mask, and I'm being only halfway facetious here. So the first thing you can do is gauge that person's support or lack of support for vaccine mandates and mask mandates, and just ask that question. I mean, are you for or against it? Now, your job becomes a little easier if they say they're for it and maybe they're really, really for it. They're really gung-ho about this stuff. And they say, okay, so wait a minute. If you're saying that you have absolute bodily autonomy, how can you be in favor of the government saying you don't have absolute bodily autonomy? Because we're going to make you get an injection of something that you may or may not want against your will. If you want to keep your job, or if you want to stay in the military, or if you want to, you know, fly an airplane, you have to have this injection. Furthermore, if you have absolute bodily autonomy, then how can you, on the one hand, say, you know, my body, my choice, and at the same time, be A-okay with mask mandates, to use another example, where people are telling you what you can and can't do with your body? So yes, it's easy if the person is really into and supportive of vaccine mandates, mask mandates, et cetera. It becomes a little bit less easy if they're not in favor of those things. But you can ask this question. And then if she says, well, yeah, I mean, absolutely. And say, well, why should you be forced? Why should you be compelled, let's say, to accept something put into your body if you don't want it in your body? For whatever reason, doesn't mean you have to be anti-vaccine. Let's just say you just, for whatever reason, you don't want that shot. Why should an external authority be able to compel you to do that? This is where things get interesting, because on the one hand, she'll want to make the rationale for how, well, it's not just your body. You're also putting other people at risk. And if you don't wear the mask, you're putting other people at risk. And what about the death toll? We have all these millions of people who died of COVID. And just let her list all those things. Because then the next step you'll take is to say, well, okay, all that being the case, well, then how can you hold this cognitive dissonance in your mind, because you're advocating for the, is really a kind of altruism that you should do the right thing because you want to help other people. Okay, fair enough. I can agree with that. Then how do you explain your logic when it comes to the other person who's inside your body? The other person who's there, different DNA, different set of organs. You know, you have a brain, you have a stomach, you have a heart, you have a liver. Well, so does that person. That person inside your body has a brain and a liver and kidneys, and they're not yours. They don't belong to your body. Now, this person's body is in you because this is the way human gestation works, but it's a separate person. So my point here, I think you can see it, is I think it's rhetorically helpful to get the person out in the open to commit to this altruistic view of the vaccine and masks and associated things, because it's predicated upon the basis that you should do this because it's the right thing to do to help other people. You don't want to kill other people. Once you've got that out in the open, then it becomes nigh impossible for the other person then to somehow then go back on that logic and in essence deny that logic and say, and yet under these circumstances, I'm free to do whatever I want with my body, including killing, proactively killing, taking the life of that unborn person. It's a greater reach to argue for that than it is to say, well, I'm not going to wear a mask, or I'm not going to get a shot because I don't care what happens to other people. So maybe try that and see how that plays out. I think you'll find it very interesting.
Okay. Yes, sir. And then quickly, my atheist brother, he said if someone wants an abortion, they will probably be bad parents anyway, so why stop them? And I was just wondering what you would say to that.
If somebody wants an abortion, they'd be bad parents anyway?
Yeah, so why stop them? So I think my brother, I call him Chairman Mao because he's so atheist. He's very, I think he's trying to say, if I understand his argument, if they want to have abortions, they're probably bad parents for wanting to have the abortion anyway, so why stop them? So they'll, I think that's his logic. I'm thinking, right. I think I've heard that argument before too, but
yeah, it's called consequentialism. It's an error, but that's what it's typically called, consequentialism. So where you look at potential consequences and say, well, it's kind of similar to, well, and it's a disgusting argument and it's logically fallacious, but there's a similar argument, which is, well, all these kids, you know, they're probably going to be poor anyway. They're probably going to get on drugs anyway. They're probably going to be in gangs anyway. They're probably going to go to jail and do crimes anyway. So let's kill them before they have a chance to do any of those things. That's another form of consequentialism.
Yeah.
So all you have to do is point that out And I mean, there are different ways to argue this point, but just explain, you know, this is a logical fallacy that just because somebody might do something in the future, therefore it would be better for you to kill them. Ask him how he feels about the death penalty. I'm guessing if he's an atheist, if he considers himself quote unquote progressive, there's nothing progressive in fact about progressives, but in any case, that's what they call themselves. Ask him how he feels about the death penalty. Ask him, you know, are you okay with the state executing criminals? Probably yes. He's going to say no. And then you're going to say, well, if this criminal has been convicted in a court, you know, he may still be innocent, in fact, but if you object to killing through lethal injection or firing squad or some other way, a convicted criminal, why on earth are you in favor of killing somebody who's innocent, who didn't do anything wrong, and only just wants to be alive? So there are different ways you can approach this, Dusty. Try those and see what happens, and maybe call me back. I'd love to hear how it turned out. But stand your ground and don't be bullied and don't be buffaloed by these pseudo-arguments that are raised. They fall apart pretty quickly. I have to take a break, and I'll be right back. You're listening to The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. And once again, thank you, thank you, thank you, as Gomer Pyle would say, for being so generous with our pledge drive this past week. Pledge drive is over, but we exceeded our goal. We're just shy of about $3.2 million. Thank you, Jesus. And my thanks to all of you. We're most grateful. If you want to participate still, go to relevantradio.com and make your pledge. I'll be right back. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
Welcome back to The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back. Once again, these car songs are going out to a certain young man out in Gallup, New Mexico, who I've heard likes the cars as much as I do and as much as Cyrus does. I posted something I want you to take a look at. Somebody sent it to me, and I wanted to share it with you. It's a global map, so all the different countries. And you'll see on each country there is a number. So the number on the United States is 37.6. The number on Canada is 41.7. The number on China is 36.7. The number on Russia is 38.9. You're saying, okay, what does this mean? Well, what it means is these numbers show the world's median ages, not the average age, the median age. And what this expresses is global aging on the one hand, where populations are getting older and older. So the median age in Canada is 41.7 years of age. But take a look at the bright spots on the map. So the bright spots would be throughout Central Africa, for example, where the median age is, say, in Nigeria, 17.9. The median age in Uganda, 16.8. Kenya, 17.4. So extremely youthful. Now, what this means is these are the countries where the birth rates remain at least normal, if not higher than normal. So the women in these countries are having babies. The women in the other countries, and Europe is the worst. I mean, oh my gosh. Europe, the average or the median age, rather, is well into the 40s. So Spain, Italy, Germany, France, England, and I know England doesn't consider themselves part of Europe, but you get the idea. Most all of Eastern Europe, Scandinavia, their median age is so old. So like Italy, 44.5 years of age is the median. In Germany, as well as in Japan, 46.1. So this tells the tale. What this means is that you can see graphically where we have a population implosion because there just are not enough children being born. And you got the other people at my end of the spectrum, and even older, of course, who are aging out and dying off. And so this creates a real problem for these societies that are used to having people there to fill the potholes and to flip the burgers and to do all the things that are necessary in a civilization. And you can see where the future lies. The future lies in Africa. The future of humanity lies in Africa. It doesn't lie in Europe, doesn't lie in the United States, certainly doesn't lie in Canada. The future is not going to be found in Japan or Russia or China or Australia or any of these other countries where we're just aging out and we're just, for whatever reason, selfishly not having children. The future lies in Africa. And everybody better get used to it because that's the facts, Jack. That's what's happening. And if you want to see it, if you want to understand it, kind of visually take a look at it, I posted this map on my Twitter feed. Take a look at it. Let's see. Let's go to Stephanie in Cromwell, Connecticut. I was just in Cromwell, Connecticut over the weekend, Stephanie. Were you at Holy Apostles by chance?
No. And when you said that, I said, oh, I wish I knew. That is so
yeah.
awesome.
Well, it was a great gathering. Well, welcome.
Thank you. I had a question and a comment to an earlier caller. My question is, because I'm just so curious what you think about this. Mm-hmm. Why do you think when people experience trauma, it often leads to feeling of shame? And, you know, especially because someone who experienced trauma, it's usually not their fault. And then why do you think we, and I say we collectively as humans, why do you think we at some point feel alone or that there's no one to talk to when that's not true?
These are really deep questions. Now, as to the first point, I don't have any training in like psychology or some of the tools that one might need to be able to assess that. So I don't know that I have an opinion that matters on why people who feel trauma feel guilty. I don't know. And I don't know to what extent that's the case. It may be widespread. I don't know. It may be because somebody who's victimized, and I think that's what you're referring to, right? Someone who's traumatized by being victimized, not by a car accident. Is that what you mean?
Right. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I mean, who knows what the dynamics, the psychological dynamics are that a psychologist or even a psychiatrist could help plumb the depths of. I wonder if maybe it's because there is a sense of, like you said, maybe a sense of shame and perhaps feeling like I brought this upon myself, or maybe the person who traumatized you said that you're to blame. Who knows? There could be all sorts of reasons like that. And that's where I think someone who's trained in counseling, and I'm not, would be in a position to give you a better answer than I can. I can only conjecture. But that would be one thing to take a look at. You know who was really good at this was the late Father Benedict Groeschel. And he was, I believe he had his PhD in psychology. Or maybe he was a psychiatrist. I think it was psychology he had his PhD in. But he was also a Catholic priest. So he had the pastoral dimension as well. And he wrote a lot about these topics. So maybe go look him up and see what books are available by him on Amazon that might speak to this issue. One is, I mean, he's written a number of books that I've recommended often on the program. He wrote a book called Arise from Darkness, What to Do When Life Doesn't Make Sense. And although he touches upon these themes, I don't know how deep he gets into this one. He also wrote a great book called The Courage to Be Chaste, which is a psychological evaluation of what are some of these real struggles that people have, which is most everybody, when it comes to being chaste. How do you do that? And how do you pick yourself up if you fall in that area? So those are two that you could take a look at, but he may have other things that are more to the point. Then the other one you mentioned here is you're asking, why do people, and I interpret what you said to be, why do people feel lonely? Is that what you mean? Mm-hmm. Why do you feel isolated?
Yeah, and kind of tied to my first question, because a lot of times people who go through trauma feel like they don't really have someone to talk to about it. Mm-hmm. And I'm just so curious about, you know, what your thoughts on why is that kind of ingrained in all of our human hearts? I mean, my thought mm-hmm. is maybe something to do with original sin, but, you know, I mean, even when we're born, we're not born alone. We're born to our mother. So why is right. it that we always feel alone?
Well, yeah. Did you have more to say on that?
No, that's all.
Okay. Well, see, this is where I wonder how person specific it may be, because although I admit, and I think most people would probably agree with me if they're being honest, and that is that there are moments, even when you're surrounded by people, you could be in a busy family, you could be in a happy marriage, and you can be surrounded by people and still feel lonely. That's one of those phenomena in our human life that is hard to avoid at times. And so whether somebody is truly alone because he's living alone, or maybe estranged from family and friends, these things happen. Or in the case of somebody who's surrounded by people who love them, and yet they still feel pangs of loneliness, that's a phenomenon that I think most people go through. And I've been through it. And I love my wife more than anything in the whole world. And all I want to do is be with her. And I think she feels the same way about me. But there can be moments in even a happy marriage where you still feel those pangs of loneliness. So my guess, Stephanie, to leapfrog over all the psychological possibilities, my guess is that it's the common human experience, because we know, without even necessarily being able to articulate it, each of us knows, you know, that you're made for something more than what you have around you. There's something more that you want. And that craving, as K.D. Lang put it, that constant craving. What is it that we're craving? Well, St. Augustine said that our hearts are restless until they rest in God. And another way to say it would be that anything or any person, eventually you'll tire of, even for a time anyway. You know how when a song comes out, you really like the song, and then you play it over and over and over again because you like it so much. Eventually you get sick of it. You don't want to hear it anymore. You've sort of expended your delight in that song. The same is true with food. You're really hungry, and you belly up to the bar, and you start eating your favorite food, and before you know it, you're satiated, and you're also kind of sick of eating. You don't want to eat anymore. It's run its course. Music, food, relationships even, all kinds of things. Just life in general is like that. And yet we still want more. We are craving a kind of fulfillment that nothing in the created world can actually give us. Well, St. Augustine says that's your appetite for God. He doesn't use the word appetite. That's your capacity for God. That's why I think people feel lonely, because they sense there's something more that I'm yearning for. I don't even quite know what it is, but I know it's there, and I know I want it, and I don't know how to get it, and all the things around me are not satisfying me in the way that I know that would satisfy me if only I figured out what it was. And what Jesus says to us is, that's God. God is what you're yearning for. God is the source of ultimate happiness. And so the more people understand that, and the more, of course, they're drawn to the Father by Jesus, the more, even if they do go through periods of feeling a little bit lonely here or there, they realize that this is only because they have not yet laid hold of God himself, which happens in heaven. So the ultimate fulfillment will take place in heaven, where nothing anymore will bother us. We'll never feel lonely because we'll have God directly. But in the meantime, we experience those pangs. So that's my theory. Stephanie, what do you think? Stephanie is speechless.
Hello there. Right.
Maybe, I think Stephanie might have her phone accidentally on mute or something. I don't know. Anyway, Stephanie, that's my take on the issue. Thanks for the question. How about Jonathan now in Houston? Good morning, Jonathan.
Good morning, Patrick. Thank you for taking my call. I've been a fan of yours for a long time.
Thank you.
Here's my question. Do you consider the changes
There it is again. I wonder if this is an issue, Cyrus.
Yeah, it's kind of that same background noise too.
Let's try Jonathan again.
Yep.
Jonathan, let's take it again. I'm going to put you on hold. Let's bring you back. Can you hear me now? Yeah. So we've got an issue. I don't know what the issue is.
Let me try one thing here, Patrick.
Okay, try one thing.
That's a long shot. Let's see if this works.
Okay, let's see.
Hey, Jonathan, can you hear us? Nope. Okay.
Okay, so here's what we'll do. We're going to work this situation here. Houston, we have a problem. Now, we're going to figure it out. We'll take a break, though, and that'll give us a chance to figure this out, and then we'll come right back. So Thank you for the call, Stephanie. I appreciate it very much. I hope that was helpful to you. Jonathan in Houston, I'm going to try to come back to you if you're there. And it sounds like you are there. I just can't hear you for some reason. So stand by. And all the other people who are waiting, please be patient. I'll be right back.
Everything's under control. Situation normal. We're fine. We're all fine here now. Thank you. How are you?
Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
Well, since I was gone, we fixed the problem. So let's see if it really worked. Let's get back to Jonathan in Houston. Hello, Jonathan.
Straight to the question.
Okay.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, now I can.
Okay, good.
Let's go.
Do you consider the changes that Pope Francis made to the Catechism regarding the death penalty as doctrinal changes?
Yes and no. They are an extension of what Pope John Paul II did when he changed the Catechism. In 1988, the first iteration of the Catechism said the language there in the section on the death penalty was considerably different from what he changed it to in 1994. So in 1988, it said that the death penalty is not immoral, it's sometimes necessary. And it was just sort of the boilerplate language that the Catholic Church had used all along. Then he wrote Evangelium Vitae, which is the Gospel of Life. And in light of what he wrote in Evangelium Vitae, in which he made a sharp turn away from the death penalty, and he elaborated his reasons why, well, then he had the Catechism revised to reflect that language. So that's when he changed the Catechism, and it was a significant change. And at that point, then, the Catechism said, in words to the effect, I don't have it in front of me, but that revision of the Catechism said that although, you know, there, you know, that it's not immoral per se, because of our modern means of incarceration, et cetera, capital punishment should be practically non-existent. And so his emphasis on a kind of a decisive turning away from capital punishment was a significant change in the Catechism. So what Pope Francis did in his revision, so he just did a bit more of what John Paul II had done, and he used a phrase that it is morally inadmissible. So when this was hot and heavy at the time, I spent a lot of time talking about it on the show, and I'll just briefly recap what I said about it. My read on this issue, and this is after having studied as diligently as possible the church's perennial teaching on the death penalty not being immoral, I would recommend a book called By Man Shall His Blood Be Shed. And it was a book co-authored by Dr. Edward Faeser and Joseph Bissett. And it's an historical and theological biblical analysis of the church's teaching on the death penalty, going all the way back to the time of the Bible. It's a tour de force demonstration that the death penalty as such is not intrinsically immoral. And so the distinction that I want to make here, Jonathan, is that in light of what Pope Francis, in light of the revisions that he made, I think that the only way that we can coherently understand this, and I said the same thing when John Paul II made his revision all those years ago, is that this reflects on the part of the Pope a pastoral attitude toward this issue of capital punishment. It can't. I mean, no pope can change a doctrine. And so the established fact, in my view, is that capital punishment is not intrinsically evil. And this has been the teaching of the church all along. However, any given pope is certainly well within his rights to say that notwithstanding, the church is not going to countenance capital punishment. The church is going to work to end capital punishment. The church is going to seek, whenever possible, to stop capital punishment, and certainly is not going to encourage capital punishment. That's a pastoral approach to the problem. It's a pastoral approach to this issue. It doesn't mean And if people mistakenly think, well, this is a development of doctrine, this is not a development of doctrine. This is not what John Henry Newman intended when he talked about a development of doctrine. This is a development of the church's pastoral approach to a topic. But when you have the Bible and popes and councils and others who definitively said that capital punishment is not intrinsically evil, you can't change that. In other words, it can't suddenly now become evil if the church has said that it isn't before. So the only way, it seems to me, to adequately understand all this is to say, yes, indeed, the Pope has a right to revise the church's pastoral approach to this topic, and that touches upon doctrine without being doctrinal itself. The last thing I'll say is this can also be changed again. So it may be that for whatever reason, a future pope may say, okay, now under the current circumstances, the church would permit or at least not strive very hard to stop capital punishment. A future pope could go in the other direction. It's entirely possible. And that, by the way, would also apply. Well, I won't get into some of the other side issues, but how does that fit? I mean, does that get to the heart of your question?
Yeah, it does. Thank you so much, Patrick. I'm sorry you had to revisit an old issue, but that helps a lot. Thank you.
Oh, you're most welcome, and I'm happy to talk about it. That's what I'm here for. Now, for anyone interested, if you want to be conversant in a fuller sense on the issue of capital punishment, you really owe it to yourself to read this book I just mentioned, By Man Shall His Blood Be Shed. And that's a commandment from God. It comes from Deuteronomy, where God is saying to Moses, here's what's going to happen when this type of crime is committed or that type of crime is committed. Certain crimes require capital punishment, and by man shall his blood be shed. That's a statement from the Lord. This book really provides the most complete analysis of the topic, and it coincided, I think it came out right around the time that Pope Francis had made this further revision to the Catechism. And I don't think anybody can really say that he's adequately up to speed on this topic without having read that book, because it is so comprehensive. Now, bear in mind, there are some who have tried to refute it. I've read some of their refutations. I've read some of the book reviews that are just very embarrassing in the case of the reviewer. So if you read a review of this book that pans it, that's okay. Read Edward Faser's response to the review. And he responds to all the reviewers, and he points out where they made their mistakes. So plenty there for you to take a look at. And I thank you for the call. Let's go now to Chris in Feasterville, Pennsylvania. Hello, Chris.
Good morning, Patrick. Thanks for taking my call. Just three very brief questions. Recently, I spoke with an apologist, the senior apologist on the Catholic Answers Program. I want to see if you agree with his opinion concerning the eternal fate of Judas. Jesus referred to Judas as the son of perdition. Mm-hmm. I looked up perdition. It means the eternal ruin of the soul, the state of the wicked, the state of the eternally damned. Jesus also said of Judas, woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would be better for that man if he had never been born. Now, this apologist stated that that does not necessarily mean that Judas went to hell. And to me, it does. I just wanted to get your opinion on that matter.
Sure. Yeah, I've talked about this, I wouldn't say many times, but I've talked about it several times. And I personally think that there is no way around the fact that Jesus was saying that Judas went to hell. And the reason is that Jesus says it would be better if that man had never been born. Well, if he went to heaven, then what does that mean? I mean, if he ended up in heaven, how would it be better if he had never been born? That doesn't make any sense, if you ask me. So that's one thing. He also says in John chapter 17, he's saying this high priestly prayer to the Father, and he says, I have protected all of them that you gave me, except, and none of them was lost except for one, and that is the son of perdition, referring to Judas. So there Jesus expressly says that Judas was lost. Also in the Catechism of the Council of Trent, which came out, not quite 500 years ago, there too we see another statement to this effect in referring to Judas as having been lost. So although it doesn't bring me any pleasure whatsoever to contemplate anybody going to hell, the preponderance of the things that Jesus did say about Judas, I don't think there's any way around it, quite honestly. Now, it's still a kind of open question, and people are free to have different interpretations. So I don't begrudge anybody from arriving at a different conclusion than the one that I've arrived at. But I think in light of the things that Jesus said, this John chapter 17, verse 12, that's where he says, and I'll just quote it to you here. He says, speaking to the Father, "When I was with them, I protected them in your name that you gave me, and I guarded them, and none of them was lost except the son of destruction, in order that the scripture might be fulfilled." So to me, that seems airtight. I can't see how you wiggle out of that one. Jesus said Judas was lost. Matthew chapter 26 is the other one. And this is in verse 24. "The Son of Man indeed goes as it is written of him, but woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It would be better for that man if he had never been born." Then Judas's betrayer said in reply, "Surely it is not I, Rabbi." He answered, "You have said so." So again, if Jesus says it's better that he never be born, how is that in any way compatible with Judas going to heaven? Because if Judas goes to heaven, then hallelujah. It is better that he was born because he wound up in heaven with God. The only way that statement makes any sense is if he didn't go to heaven, if he went to hell. I don't see any way around that also. And then also in John chapter 6, verse 70, Jesus answered them, "Did I not choose you 12? Yet is not one of you a devil?" He was referring to Judas, son of Simon the Iscariot. It was he who would betray him, one of the 12. So those are just a few, but mainly the most important ones, if you ask me on this issue. So I have great esteem for my colleagues at Catholic Answers. Love those guys, and they do wonderful work. So I don't in any way want to give the impression that I'm pitting myself against them. But this is one of those issues where reasonable people have a difference of opinion on this issue, and that's my opinion.
Thank you, Patrick.
You're welcome.
Patrick, you also mentioned there's some credit cards now that are funding the abortion of women. I think you mentioned the Citibank. I recently found out also American Express. If a Catholic is aware of this, would you say that a Catholic who continues to use those cards, being aware of this, is committing a mortal sin?
No, I definitely would not say that. I would say that if you are in a position to be able to avoid doing business with banks like that, so much the better. But your remote participation is so remote and it's unintentional that you're not morally culpable of the evil of abortion. But again, if it's possible for you to starve them of your money, so much the better. But no, I don't think that there's any mortal sin being committed. And this list extends far beyond Citibank and American Express. If you use Energizer batteries, or if you use Adobe for PDFs on your computer, if you have Microsoft programs on your computers, the list is very long and it's all encompassing. Everything you do, everything you buy, every airline you fly on, practically, all of these different facets of your life have also been corrupted in the same way. So if you were to say, well, if you have a Citibank card, you better get rid of it. I would have no objection to anybody saying, I'm definitely getting rid of it because I don't want to do business with a company that does that. But if you were consistent, you'd have to eliminate just about every other aspect of your life, and the cleaning products and the clothing and the life insurance and the computers. You'd have to get rid of all of it, because virtually all of it now, in one way or another, is feeding into that. It's terrible, but it's true. Thanks, Chris. Let's go to Greg in Baltimore now. Hello, Greg.
I was wondering if there were any miracles associated with the Shroud of Turin.
Very interesting question. I'm not aware off the top of my head that any of them are, or that there are any, rather. But there is a Shroud Center in Santiago. It's at the Santiago Retreat Center in Southern California. And if you were to go there, I'm going to pull up their website address for you so you can check it out. So it's, is it shroudcenter.com? Yeah, it's shroudcenter.com. Mm-hmm. And this is a resource that contains about as much information as exists on the Shroud of Turin, scientific information, cool, historical, etc. Now, I don't know, but I haven't even been told if there are any miracles associated with the Shroud. I think the Shroud itself is a miracle. I think it's like the tilma of Our Lady of Guadalupe. I think it is in itself a miracle. But miracles of healing or raising people from the dead may be associated with it. I just don't know off the top of my head. But gotcha. That website can give it to you.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, glad I could help. Let's go, let's see. I don't think we have enough.
Go ahead.
Another phone call.
Make my day.
All right, if you say so. Let's go to Rocco in New York. Hello, Rocco.
How you doing? Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to comment on what you said before. You were talking about this woman that was talking about her child in the school, about teaching them about the gender. Okay. And I'm totally against all that. But also, you said something last week about they're passing a law in Massachusetts. I don't know if it was Massachusetts or Rhode Island that's teaching the same thing about sexual stuff with children. And I just think that this ideology is ridiculous. And it's I wanted to get your thoughts on it. If you thought that it changed from the 50s, you had all shows about the family, and now family, they don't want family anymore. This ideology about let's get rid of the families and let's get rid of children. Let's get rid of everything that's wholesome and good.
I hear what you're saying. So there certainly is a marked trend in entertainment in this country anyway, that has dramatically shaped people's view of the family and view of fathers in particular, and distorted it as a result. I think All in the Family, Norman Lear's All in the Family back in the 70s was the tip of the spear in accomplishing this. So yeah, I'm out of time, Rocco. I wish I had more time. But I acknowledge the point you're making. It is a real phenomenon, and I think the sources of this are various. So perhaps we can pick this up another time. Thank you. Thanks again for helping us with Pledge Drive. We sure appreciate it. We met our goal and then some. Thank you for that. Until tomorrow, I'll pray for you. Please pray for me. Now.